أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجترحدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمام ولا يناله غوص الفطن. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين على عبد المعيد الرسول المسدد المصطفى العمجد المحمود الأحمد سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولقد ذرعنا لجهنم كثيرا من الجن والإنس لهم قلوبا لا يفقهون بها ولهم أعين لا يبصرون بها ولهم أذان لا يسمعون بها أولئك كالأنعام بل هم أضل أولئك هم الغافلون. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل
محمد. Developing Islamic courage has been our topic from day number one. Tonight is lecture number 5 and is our final lecture of this mini-series. Let me first of all thank Al-Walaya and all of you, my gracious host as well, for allowing someone like me to waste your time every single evening and sit on the member like this and to invite me to such beautiful days. As Ali Bhai mentioned, this is no doubt a home for me now, and we don't spend too long away from home usually, so your salawats are effective, however. Like I said, as long as there's no snow on the ground in LA and the palm trees are still green, then I'll come back. It's not a problem. As long as Mickey and Minnie don't leave, then I won't either. Secondly, we send our condolences to the Imam of our time, to the Rahbar of the Ummah, to the Maraji and all of you. On this being the night of the Shahadat of our fourth Imam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wassalam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us amongst the Sajideen, inshaAllah. Our topic, those of you who have been with me since day number one, has been revolving around the concept of shuja'at, of courage in Islam. What does it mean to be a courageous individual? What does it mean when Islam talks about the concept of being a shaji in Islam? We eliminated the fact that physical courage is not what is meant here, of course. We're not talking about individuals who are physically strong or brute strength or the concept of how many bodies can one kill or how much blood can one shed. But rather it is a courage of morality, a courage of spirituality, where you are putting your own desires aside and making the deen of Islam number one in your world. The courageous one is that individual who does what the deen requires him to do at that specific time. The lessons from the story of Karbala are many. One lesson is the fact that as difficult as it was for many of the warriors of the day of Ashura to sit in the tent and watch the kids go thirsty, watch their Mawla go thirsty, and know that if they're given ijazat, they can fix all of that, but yet they did what Islam needed them to do at that moment. That's courage. We live in an era right now of fitna, fasad, oppression, injustice, tyranny, and confusion, unfortunately. The masses are confused, and we also are confused. We don't know what to do. We don't know what our role is, what our takalif is, what our wazifa is, what our responsibility is. And so we have two choices. Either we follow the leadership, our maraji, or we basically follow our own whims and desires, what we believe is the correct action plan right now, given the fact that what's happening around the Ummah, and it's very clear to us what's happening right now around the Ummah. The discussion of courage has many effects to it. One of them is that you end up opening your eyes of basirat, of insight. You become an insightful individual. The verse I read for you in the khutbah today and yesterday from Surah Al-A'raf, ayat number 179, is a very beautiful one and talks about those qualities inside of a human being that Allah saw, and based on those qualities, He created the hellfire. Meaning these are individuals this verse is describing that was the motivation behind the creation of the hellfire. And there were three qualities. لَهُمْ قُلُوبًا لَا يَفْقَهُونَ بِهَا. They have hearts, they don't understand anything deeply. Everything is surface level. وَلَهُمْ أَعْيُونٌ لَا يُبْصِرُونَ بِهَا. They have eyes, they don't see anything. They look at everything, they don't see anything. وَلَهُمْ أَذَانٌ لَا يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا. They have ears, they don't listen to anybody or anything. They hear a lot, but they don't listen to anything. They are like what? أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْعَنْعَامِ. They're like cattle, they're animals. Where the herd goes, they go. They don't break off from the herd. If the herd is going down a cliff, they'll go down a cliff. بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلٍ. In fact, they're worse than that. They are amongst the غَافِلُونَ, the heedless ones. They're told time and time again. They're warned time and time again. The news is in front of them. How much blood needs to be shed, how many bodies need to be killed, how many Shias need to be slaughtered for us to wake up as an Ummah, I don't know. They are completely and absolutely ghafil, they're heedless. خَتَمَ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ. Their hearts have been sealed, the Quran says. No matter how much you try to poke at them and get them and wake them up and shake them and spark them, nothing truly happens. And so this concept of courage and insight and basirat is important. In this day and age, when they've wrapped up haq inside the package of fitna and fasad and presented it to the masses to be the only possible truth, our youth are confused. It's one thing where you have complete truth, it's one thing where you have complete falsehood. Complete haq, complete batil is one thing. And those are very easily identifiable. But Amir al-Mu'mineen brings about a third category that's even more dangerous. And that is a pinch of haq and a pinch of falsehood mixed together to create fitna and corruption and presented to the masses to be the truth. And if you don't have the internal kingdom open in terms of your eyes, if you rely on these limited eyes of yours to truly understand, or your limited understanding to understand what's happening around the world, you'll be confused. You'll be lost. You'll actually believe that ISIS is a Sunni group. You'll actually begin to believe that we shouldn't support Palestine because the majority of the recruits of ISIS are Palestinians. Because you're relying on a very limited amount of vision. Whereas Islam requires much more from you. A mu'min is not somebody who simply relies on this vision. This vision is a tool by the soul. True eyesight is insight in Islam. to be an insightful individual, to look at something past its zahir and look at its batin. The day of Ashura is in front of us. It's a darsgah for us. It's a university for us. On one side, you have individuals from the nation of the Holy Prophet, 50 years after the man dies. Individuals who knew the Prophet, who were companions of the Prophet, quote unquote, who walked with him, who talked with him, who ate with him. On one side, ready to kill the very grandson that they saw with their own eyes, was beloved for the Holy Prophet. He would sit on the knee of the Holy Prophet when he was 4 years old in a masjid, and the Prophet would kiss his neck constantly and kiss his forehead constantly and say, "Hussein minni wa ana min Hussein." Everyone witnessed that. Nobody could ever say that I didn't know that Hussein was so dear to the Holy Prophet. Impossible. Not just one, not just two, not 1,000, 30,000 individuals were able to sit there and watch the grandson of the Holy Prophet be slaughtered on the day of Ashura. You have that on one side. On the other side, you have companions of Abu Abdullah. Blows out the candle in the middle of the night. Go from here. They want my head on a spear. And they would say, "Let's do this. 1,000 times again, I'll do it again for you. If I need to die, I want to die beside you, Abu Abdullah." It's not like Imam Hussein gave him false hopes. It's not like Imam Hussein said, "Look, tomorrow's the day of Ashura. Some might survive, some may get killed." No, every single one of you will be killed, brutally killed tomorrow. Your exit is there. Your Jannat now is wajib on you. You have made your labbaik to me. You don't need to shed your blood anymore. But they would drown themselves in Hussein like Hussein drowned himself in Allah. This two distinct groups on one day from one ummah. And the one difference ulama say is that one group had what's called basirat, insight, and the other group didn't. One group, all they saw was the fact that Yazid said the one who inflicts the most amount of pain on Hussein has the biggest reward waiting for him. And all they saw was Yazid's false promises. Such that when all the bodies were shaheed, it wasn't enough that they left them on the ground unburied. Umar ibn Sa'd calls for horses to come and trample these bodies. He says, "I want 2 horses for each body. I want 10 for Hussein." And he says to his army, "I want you to bear witness and go back to Yazid and tell him it was me who caused the most harm to Hussein's dead body." Umar ibn Sa'd was the man who was in some books would play in the streets of Medina with Hussein. Shimr ibn Dhuljoshan, la'natullah alayh, was a man who fought in Siffin beside Amir al-Mu'mineen against Muawiyah. Ibn Muljim, who was responsible for the shahadat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, was a man who gave bayat on Ghadir. These guys aren't people who didn't know what they were doing. What happened, Shimr, in a matter of 20 years, you go from supporting the father to being responsible for the shahadat. Individuals like Abdullah ibn Abbas. Who was Abdullah ibn Abbas? What's his story? Very quickly, again, history, history, history. I keep pounding it home for the past 5 nights. Read history. When Yazid came into power, he wanted bayat from 4 individuals because these 4 refused it. Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Zubair, Abdullah ibn Abbas, and Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. These 4 individuals refused to give bayat. The 3 of them would approach Imam Hussein and says, "Don't go to Kufa, go to Yemen, go to Basra, go somewhere else and live your life quietly. Don't rattle the snake, don't rock the boat. Who's saying this? Abdullah ibn Abbas, one of the closest Sahabis of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The first Mufassir of the Quran that wasn't a Ma'asum was Abdullah ibn Abbas. A governor during Imam Ali's Khilafat. He did some things with the money of the government that Imam Ali didn't like. And Imam Ali was a man who wouldn't easily forgive his governors. The good news was that he was Imam Ali's governor. The bad news was that he was Imam Ali's governor. The good news was that Imam Ali chose him. The bad news was that Imam Ali chose him. So the scrutiny of Imam Ali, when it came to his governors, was there was a zero tolerance policy. You pick up Nahj al-Balagha, letter number 45. The governor of Basra, Uthman ibn Hunayf, very famous letter. He went bachara to a davat, a banquet, a wedding of someone who's rich. Somebody who's rich in the community invited him. He went there. Imam Ali found out, wrote him a 3-page letter. Abdullah ibn Abbas did something with money. He wasn't fair. Perhaps he gave more to his family. Imam Ali didn't like it. Wrote a very harsh letter. Within the akhlaq boundaries, of course. Abdullah didn't like it. He didn't like it. And since that moment, he separated himself away from Imam Ali. And when the fitna of the death of the third Khalifa was spreading that it was Ali who killed him, he didn't defend Imam Ali at all. When Imam Hussein went towards Karbala, Abdullah ibn Abbas was not there. Who was this man? Like I told you, one of the most senior companions of Imam Ali. A student of Imam Ali. The Khawarij movement, the Kharijis, again history guys, that group that broke off from Siffin. When the war of Nahrawan during Imam Ali's Khilafat, that war between Imam Ali and this Khawarij movement had begun. Imam Ali sent Abdullah ibn Abbas to go talk to them, negotiate, let's not go to war. What is it that they want? Abdullah goes and meets with the head of the Khawarij tribe. They talk, they discuss, Abdullah comes back. The companions of Imam Ali rush towards Abdullah and say, look, can you describe who these guys are? What are they like? How are they? Look at Abdullah's description. He says that their knees are worn out from sajda of Allah. Their foreheads bleed from sajda on the earth. Their lips are dry, cracking from the dhikr of Allah. 90% of them are hafiz al-Quran. They're in a constant mode of ibadat. What's their one problem? They're going to war with Amir al-Mu'mineen. What's my point? My point is that if we don't have that courage, we become complacent. We become comfortable. We believe the amount that I have is enough. I understand the Ahlul Bayt. I love the Ahlul Bayt. Should be enough. We don't move forward. We have ample amount of examples in history of people who were the closest to the Ahlul Bayt. But one small imtihan, one small test, and their true colors came out. I can give you 1,000 more examples. The Waqifi group, Imam Qadim alayhi salatu wassalam. There was a group that existed in the 7th Imam's time who believed in Imam Qadim's imamate. But this same group, when Imam Radha alayhi salam was made the imam, and he didn't have Imam Jawad until he was 47 years old. That late in his life, no other imam had their son that late in their life. To the point where this group now began to doubt the imamate of our 8th imam. Saying, look, if you are truly an imam, you'd have a son by now. And because it's been so late, there's no way you're the imam. So we'll stop believing after the 7th imam. We'll do waqf, we'll stop. They're called the waqafis. And the 7th imam for us is Imam Zamana. Okay? Now, they don't exist today, but they were very important back then. Who was the leader of the Waqafi group? The man in charge of the treasury of Imam Kadhim's government, appointed by our seventh Imam. He had some qualities, right, to be part of Imam's government. The Imam doesn't choose anybody and everybody, right? And a little bit of a change in the movement, a little test that the Imam that you believe in now at the age of 47 now is having his son, all of a sudden the entire system of Imamat is out the window. And your Iman is gone. That Imam that made you the head of treasury is now that same Imam that you believe to be Imam al-Zamana. The next five Imams, you reject. It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. The little that we have is not enough. That will be swallowed and engulfed with one test. The Kufans are in front of us. The Kufans are in front of us. 30,000 people, 25,000, 18,000. These numbers aren't jokes. If you had 18,000 text messages, you'd go crazy, wouldn't you? If you had 10, 15, 20 in a row, 18,000 were sent to Imam Hussein. Back then, you would send a carrier. He would go on foot. Can you imagine how many times the door's knocking? Another letter for you, Imam Hussein. One more for you, Imam Hussein. One more for you, Imam Hussein. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands. This was after the head of the group in Kufa had said, look, if you believe that you cannot support the Imam, don't write him a letter, please. If you have fear in your heart of the government in Kufa, do us a favor and don't call the Imam. Don't set him up like that. After all of those warnings, they wrote letters upon letters. And a little bit of a test when it came to your job and your family and your wife and your kids and your health, and they bolted, they left. And they left Musab ibn Aqil to wander the streets of Kufa looking for a drop of water. Gharib Kufa is a very beautiful title for him. He was actually very gharib. The few that he had that were hardcore were in prison. The likes of Mukhtar, the likes of Habib, Hani, they're all in prison. The rest of them, a little bit of a threat from Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, and they were gone. They were gone. My brothers and my sisters, we live in an era where we believe that the iman of the people in the East is being tested right now. That test will make its way across the ocean into our backyard, if not already. The test will change. The test will have a different face to it. But there's no doubt our iman will be tested here in the West. We have to stay ready. How do we stay ready? Constantly climb up that mountain. Don't be complacent. We do that by what? Comparing ourselves to others. I'm not that bad. Comparing ourselves, let's say, to other people in society who are non-Muslim. I know friends, mom and dad, who drink and get high and this and that, have had abortions, blah, blah, blah. I haven't even done any of that stuff. So I'm better than they are. Right away now, what you've done is any talk of Islam and reform out the window. I'm okay where I am. And all we're doing is we're maintaining our head above the water. That's all we're doing. It's very difficult. We have people all over history that lived with the Imams, that were ready to die with the Imams, that were chosen by the Imams to be part of their government. And the smallest of tests, I mean, you're threatening this guy that if you, I mean, think about it, if you leave the path of Imam Hussein, I'll let you keep your job. If you support Abu Abdullah, I'll make sure that you lose your job. Thousands left the path of Imam Hussein for that one threat of a job. One threat of that job. We think, oh, these Kufans, man, they're, you know, bad bakht, as you say in Farsi. They are worthy of being called mal'oons, no doubt. Sometimes we see that here. We apply for a job. What do? We either trim the beard down to the point where you have to look at the beard and say, is there a beard there? Yeah, there's a beard there. A little bit too thick, she won't hire me. The thick says you can't shake her hand. If I don't shake her hand, I'm going to lose my job. What do we do? How are you? We're good. How are you, ma'am? I'm doing well. How are you? Nice tight squeeze, mashallah. Because that firmness of the handshake is a lock for that job. As if she's our Razik. If I don't please her, I won't get the job. So I'll please her and upset him in the process. And I believe that job is mine. The Kufans had that test. We have this test today. And some of us are losing that test. Our iman slips out very, very easily. Courage, courage. It's not easy in this day and age to keep up with your iman. It's not easy. And those of you who like to fight against oppression and injustice, you're being bombarded constantly. You're out there chanting to free Sheikh Nimr. There's 40 of you, 45 of you, 15 of you, 5 of you, I don't care. The voices will come, you're wasting your time. You think they hear you, there's 5 of you. It's freezing cold out here, stop doing that, go inside, you look foolish. And 2 will remain, and 3 will say, yeah, you're right, it's wasting my time. Or Al-Quds rally comes, you see the dhulm happening, you see the fact that when they attack Gaza, they attack schools of small children sleeping in that school at 3 o'clock in the morning, they destroy that school. And kids in their sleep are blown to pieces. We're watching that dhulm. When it comes time for someone like me to come out and say, come out for Al-Quds, no way, those guys are nasibis, man. They hate Imam Ali. How dare we support people like that? What we don't realize is that Palestine isn't about Palestine. Palestine is about uprooting Zionism. The root of every evil in Pakistan, in Bahrain, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in ISIS, in the White House, everywhere, the root of that is Zionism. You can trim the branches all you want, they'll grow back. If you uproot the tree, they won't come back. Palestine is that embodiment, that manifestation of the dhulm of Zionism. That's where the jud is, the markaz is, the center is. We rip it out, everything else falls down. We can trim the branches, no problem. The tree will remain to be strong. Uproot that tree altogether. That's why Ayatollah Khamenei constantly saying Palestine, Palestine. And we're so low-minded. We're like, what about Iraq? What about our Shias in Pakistan? No, the fight for Palestine is a fight for Pakistan. The shout against Zionism is a shout against Sipah Sahaba and Takfiris and Saudis. It's all one big monster. But the one controlling the monster is Zionism. We don't see that, why? Because we don't have the courage and the eyes of insight to understand that. So what do? We question a man who's the greatest leader of our time. And we label those who promote him as extreme individuals. We don't even attend the buildings where he's mentioned. This is our state in the West right now. And then we say, wa'ajjil farajahum. No, Baba, he's not coming, I'm sorry. He's not. Stop calling him. Prepare yourself, then call him. Stop calling him. This double standard won't do it. If you can't accept the naib, you won't accept the imam. Very simple. Let's first work on that first. This is where we're at now. This courage business is real, guys. My youth out there, it's not time now to be apolitical. It's not time to run from the word siyasat. It's not a dirty word. It's a dimension of the religion. It's become dirty because we resort politics to be a different center down the road. That's not politics. That's jahalat, that's ignorance. That's disunity. That's not politics. We require, this zamana requires a lot of courage. To remain the path, it requires a lot of courage. If we don't build that shuja'at inside of us, then God forbid we'll be people like Abdullah ibn Abbas, we'll be people like Shimr ibn Zuljoshin, we'll be people like the Kharijis, like the Waqifis, like so on and so on and so forth, who had the iman at one time, but they were gone. And gone so far, they become not the Sahabi of the Ahlul Bayt, the Qatilin of the Ahlul Bayt. Can you imagine? Ibn Muljim, Bakhin, Dayyab Ghadir, Qad Qutla Amir al-Mu'mineen. Shimmer bin Zadoshin, on the day of Siffin, Labbaik Ya Ali, Qad Qutula Husayn bi Karbala. Oh my goodness. Is it possible? It's possible. I'm not saying we'll go down that route extremely. I'm saying it's possible that we can completely go off the path if we're not careful. Don't be comfortable with where you are in your iman and faith, because that's going to be tested and squeezed out and pulled out eventually. Because history has a very funny way of doing what? Repeating itself over and over and over again. We believe that we're not the people of Jahiliyyah. I was having a talk today with a brother. We're like, at least those individuals were Jahil. They didn't have access to knowledge. Our Jahalat is, despite the fact that we have access to information and knowledge and scholars, we're still ignorant, unfortunately. That is a Jahalat that is a very dangerous level. Imam Ali says there are those who don't know, and they don't know that they don't know. They don't know, they don't know. They think they know everything. They don't know. No one's told them that what you're doing is wrong. We live in a very, very delicate era. And it's about high time we take that next step where we don't run from discussions like these. Don't roll our eyes when someone like me gets up here and starts to mention the P word, Palestine, or the K word, Khamenei, and we become itchy and uncomfortable and look to our phones. Awkward, no. We don't need to do that. It's now high time that we become politically sound and active individuals. If you can't get out in the streets and chant, at least in the heart of your hearts, pray for the people of Palestine. Pray for the people of Iraq and Pakistan. Pray for the protection of our leadership. If you can't get out there on the streets, you're scared to, it's not me, that's fine. But there are some of us who not only don't support the cause, but we do things to hurt the cause. That's what is mind-blowing to me. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Let's wake up as a nation, please. Let's rise up as a nation. The enemy is far ahead of us. The enemy is far ahead of us. There's a reason why from day number one up until now, the ziyarat of Abu Abdullah has been always difficult. Always difficult. There used to be a time when you had to sacrifice a limb just to say assalamu alaykum ya Abu Abdullah. There have been people who have sacrificed their children to say assalamu alaykum ya Abu Abdullah. And there are people today who live in a war-torn country where a bomb can go off any second and they run towards Abu Abdullah. And the enemy knows this. Enemy has completely recognized the fact that this Shia nation is powered by Husayn ibn Ali. If we can do everything we can to lower that system of Azadari, use that same Azadari to split them into groups, then we've done our job. Because their motivational factor is Azadari. Their leadership is Marjiyat. Their funding is Khums. And every one of those three right now, from Khums to Marjiyat to Azadari, is a direct target of the enemy. There are people who I know who have come to me with a lot of himmat to say, Maulana, I have made Khums haram on myself. Absolutely. Straight face. Why? To me, it's a money laundering system for the Mulanas who sit there and they drive their Benzes and they have their 5,000 square foot homes. So I made it haram on myself. We have people like that in this day and age. We have people in this day and age, scholars out of the Hausa, who sit there and challenge the very essence of Marjiyat. Allah made us free thinkers. Why do we rely on Eastern ulama who live in small homes and caves to try to understand the Western problem? That's what our youth say sometimes, right? I said, but they haven't even set foot once in LA. They don't feel my pain. Let me address that here, well, since I'm already warmed up. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And yes, and yes, I purposely choose these discussions to be my last speech because I'm leaving tomorrow morning. So I light the place on fire and I walk away. And I leave it up to people like Ali Bhai and Sister Masuma to put the fire out. Good luck to you guys. Look, let's start from, I'm going to say ground zero, that's not a good example. Let's start from block number one. Ideal versus non-ideal. Follow me for a second here. Logic or aql. Do you remember the aql? The aql. It's there somewhere, inshallah. It dictates to us that where the ideal is not possible, the next best option, we accept. I'll give you an example. These are very foolish examples, just bear with me. There are 10 individuals in your society. All of you with me, inshallah? I hope I haven't upset anybody so far. You guys are with me, inshallah? Yes? Send me a nice loud salat ala Muhammad. I know a lot of you are wishing that I had my cough back so I wouldn't talk, but I'm sorry. It's gone. It's gone, yeah. Alhamdulillah. So, 10 individuals from society who are the cream of the crop. Doctors, lawyers, teachers, businessmen, mothers, ulama, people who really, a society can't function without them. 10 of them. They're all drowning in the ocean. You have the resources to save 7 of them. Just 7. And you're told that you can save 7 of them. You have 2 choices now. One choice is to save all 7. One choice is that, look, either I save all 10 or I save nobody. Please follow me for a second. What is ideal? Ideal is you save all? Save all 10. That's ideal. There's nobody in this room, at least I hope not, that would choose the second option. Either it's ideal or it's nothing. Please follow me. Nobody in this room would sit there and tell me that, look, if we can't save all 10, then we let all 10 drown. Everybody in this room would agree that as many people as we can save, we'll save. If not 7, even 1 person, we can save that person, we'll save them. Where the ideal is not possible, the next best option is always accepted. All of you will save all 7 of them. That's one example. The second foolish example is this. Your friend and you decide to go to the beach. They're pretty deep in the water and they're swimming. Someone yells shark. And the shark comes and begins to attack your friend. And you see this. You go and you swim to help your friend. And you see underwater that the shark has a pretty good bite of the leg of your friend. 2 options. One, you can say, look, that leg is gone. And either I save the person with 1 leg, or I say, look, there's no point. Either I save all your limbs, or I don't save you at all. Good luck to you, and you swim back to shore. None of you in this room would choose the second option. You'd always say, you know what? Let's save him, albeit with 1 leg. Ideal is what? Both legs to be saved. Limbs are functional. He's safe and sound. Non-ideal is what? He's alive. He's out of the clutches of the shark, but he has 1 leg. Where ideal is not possible, non-ideal, the next best option, is always accepted. Ideally, the imam of our time should be leading our ummah. Ideally, the imam didn't come. Imams weren't sent to be in ghaibat. Imams were sent to be amongst the people. Imams were sent to guide the people. Imams were sent to live amongst the people. Our imam, unfortunately, is not with us. He's here, he's not accessible. Non-ideal now takes over. The next best option after a ma'asum imam is a man who has spent 50, 60 years studying the life of the imam. And logic dictates that where the ideal is not possible, the next best option is accepted. Right now, in the world of marji'at, these are men, individuals, who have spent their entire life from when these guys were this age, 15, 14, 13, 10. Some of the books that are right now taught in the Hausa. Some books that are right now understood by some of the senior scholars are written by the writer when he was 19 or 20 years old. For example, I was having a discussion with a brother here who's reading the book Adab al-Salat by Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. Adab al-Salat is a very difficult book. It's not easy to read that book. Those of you who have tried, you can attest to that. One paragraph takes several readings to understand. Imam Khomeini wrote that book when he was 21 years old. And even now, there are individuals, ulama, who can't quite grasp that book. Where the ideal is not possible, the next best option is accepted. These maraji that we like to throw under the bus sometimes, they don't understand. Apna fatwa, apne jeb mein rakhiya. You even heard that in the minbar. Take your fatwas and put it in your pocket. It's good for where you are. It doesn't work here. That much disrespect for individuals who have completely and absolutely devoted their life for the deen to make your life easier. Just follow them. If they're right or they're wrong, they'll be blamed, not you. And my youth, sometimes you know what ends up happening? Is we send an email, let's say, to a marja's office. Right? The very famous email that we send. It's a long question, right? We talk about, you know, my friends, we talk about names, we talk about streets and restaurants, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of this long story, we have a question. And weeks later, the answer comes with one line on it. Right? Happens all the time. And our youth just go crazy. They want to throw the laptop across the room. Who are these people? You know, they will call me up and say, look, you know, I poured my heart out and he gave me one liner as an answer. Did he even read the question? Does he even feel our pain? Remember one thing. The rulings of a marja are principle based, not situational based. They're based on certain principles. If that principle fits in your situation, then you apply it. If it doesn't fit, you don't apply it. We're not robots. We're telling me, master, what to do. No. The marja will say, this is a situation now, you apply it. We are what's called mukallifin. Mukallifin are people who are responsible, who are able now to think with their own brain. Right? Sometimes you guys ask us questions, and we give you a 25-minute answer. At the end of the answer, you'll say, so is it halal or haram? Can I or can't I? Right? Look, I've given you the principles, now just ask yourself, does it apply to this pizza shop, this restaurant, or not? Right? It's principle-based, not situational-based. And those principles are based on the Quran, on the Sunnah, on Aql, and these things are universal. They're not geographical. The Quran does not change in Iran or Iraq, or in LA or in Toronto. The Aql is the Aql in Iran and Iraq, the Aql is here. The Sunnah has been the Sunnah all since day number one. Whether it's there or it's here. This whole talk about the idea they're living in the East in some cave, they have no idea what I'm going through here, is all the works of individuals who are pounding millions of dollars trying to dismantle this marjiyat system. Leadership, funding, and motivational factors. Three things for any ideology to survive. Leadership is our marjiyat, our rahbariyat. That's being attacked. Our funding is our khums. That's being attacked. Our motivational factor is this farsha adha. We get our motivation from the majas of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. And all three of these are being attacked one by one by one. Let's open up our eyes. Look how far the dushman is. Look how much the enemy knows. Look how much they've researched us. And we're stuck on minor issues. Where are we and where should we be? I talked about that yesterday. That migration from Mawjood to Matloob, from is and should be. Let's open up our eyes, understand what's happening around the world. Why is it that everything when it comes to this idea of ISIS is Islamic Khilafat? The Islamic government, the Islamic state, Islamic state. In every article, the Islamic state is mentioned. Why? Stop and ask yourself. Why are they pounding these two words home? Because they know that when the actual Islamic state comes to establish itself, will have a negative connotation towards it. Think about it, guys. Think about it. Khilafat, 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 khilafat. When the Khalifa that we're waiting for actually comes, the Imam, the Wali, the Khalifa comes, we hear him as a Khalifa, we'll be up in arms. Oh my goodness, no. Because it's become so badnam, that word. It's become tainted. The Islamic State has become tainted. I know organizations whose acronyms are too close to ISIS, so they change their name. Because I don't want them to confuse us for ISIS. That's where we are right now. And during during the days of Muhammad Safar, we'll take down black flags, we'll pull up green flags. Because we don't want from afar someone to think that this is ISIS center. Look at how much they have on us. The man that we are here to commemorate tonight was a man of courage. His khutbah that he gave in that darbar of Yazid, Allahu Akbar. What a khutbah that was. I asked my youth, there are beautiful YouTube videos that are on this topic. YouTube videos. He would sit there, a man was shackled. I mentioned the journey last night. I mentioned the fact that this long journey, in the state that he was sick, he stood there in the courtyard of Yazid, asking to speak. Yazid said no. The people would say to Yazid, this man is broken. Look at him, man. He's nothing. What will he possibly do to you? He stands there. He looks at Yazid in the eye. He says that those who know me, they know me. Those who don't know me, I'm the son of Mecca and Mina. I'm the son of Zamzam and Al-Safa. I'm the son of the greatest man to ever wear clothes. I'm the son of the greatest man to ever walk barefoot. I'm the son of the greatest man to ever do tawaf of the Kaaba. I'm the son of the greatest man who elevated towards the heavens on his buraq. He says, I'm the son of Muhammad the Mustafa. I'm the son of Ali the Murtaza. And one by one, he says, Ana, 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 I am this, I am this, I am this. And then finally, he says that I am the son of Fatima, the greatest woman in this universe. He stood there in the courtyard of Yazid and said, I am the son of that man who was slaughtered, Zibhad, on the plains of Karbala. My brothers and my sisters, it's a very difficult thing to say and to hear. 11 imams were shaheed, 9 were poisoned, 2 were struck with a sword. Imam Ali was both. He was struck with a poisonous sword, but the sword didn't kill him. The poison killed him. Imam Hussein was the only man that when Shimr ibn Zuljoshan sat on his chest and ran that blade 13 times across that dry neck of his, Imam Hussein was still alive. The act of the Zibha killed Imam Hussein. Not that he was already dead. And he sits there and says, I am the son of that man who was Zibhad, who was slaughtered on the plains of Karbala, whose blood was spilled on the plains of Karbala. When the entire courtyard was in tears, that's when Yazid, just like his father, desperate tactics, calls the Muazzin and says, give the Adhan. They know the Ahlul Bayt will respect the Adhan. Allahu Akbar came. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah came. Ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulullah came. Imam Sajjad said, stop. Tell me, Yazid, is this Muhammad your grandfather or is he mine? If you say he's your grandfather, you're a liar. If you say he's my grandfather, then why are my women and his daughters paraded around town like they are. If you say that he is my grandfather, why am I shackled and whipped the way I am? If you say that he is my grandfather, then why did you kill his Hussein on the day of Ashura? It takes immense courage to look at a man like Yazid and say these things to his face. Shab Shahadat of Imam Sajjad, the Khalifa of the time, Walid is the one that poisoned Imam Sajjad. He was alive 33 years after the event of Karbala. If you can summarize what Imam Sajjad did in those 33 years, he kept the dhikr of Hussein alive. He would go to any gathering, a happy gathering, a sad gathering, and he would make sure that before you start anything, you remember my gharib Baba on the day of Ashura. He would make sure that when he passes by an animal being sacrificed, he would ask the man, did you give this animal some water? They say, Mola, we don't sacrifice. We don't sacrifice any of our animals without first giving them water. He'd begin to cry and say, hi, Hussein. Piase Hussein. My Baba was the one who was zibhad with a drop of water. 33 years this man made sure that nobody forgot the day of Ashura. Even to the point where his final moments in his life, he didn't worry about his own journey, his own kids. He kept remembering his Ghareeb father. When the poison had reached his body and spread all over his body, his few last wishes, Imam Muhammad Bakr was there, Zayd was there, the Bani Hashim were there, all of Medina were there. They say the biggest funeral in Medina's history was that of Imam Sajjad. The amount of respect that they took out his janazah, no other imam had that respect. Can you imagine thousands upon thousands there to give him kafan, to give him dafan, to carry his body to Baqi, to bury his body with respect? All of that, and you think for a moment he thinks about anything else? His only thought in his mind, my heart tells me this, is that I have 1,000 people around me when I'm dying, but my gharib Hussein was by himself on the day of Ashura. Not one man to pick up a pile of dirt and drop it on my father's body. Why do I deserve such respect? He would ask his children, take me off the bed and put me on the ground. They say, Baba, it's better for you on the bed. He says, no, I don't want to be on the bed. Put me on the ground. They'll put him on the ground. He'd say, move this carpet from here and put me on the khak. He's like, Baba, why? You're in pain. This is going to further bother you. He goes, I want to be on the khak during my last days of this life. Why Imam Sajjad? Because it was my Baba who on his last days in this world laid there on the burning sand of Karbala. Every moment of his life, every moment of his death, Imam Sajjad remembered Imam Hussein. Imam Sajjad had a camel, a naqa as they say in Farsi, a camel, very famously. For 25 years, that camel took Imam Sajjad everywhere. Multiple hajjs. Very loyal to Imam Sajjad. When Imam Sajjad's body was buried in Baqi, and the companions came back to the home for Taziyat and Bursa, somebody asked Imam Muhammad Bakr, I don't see your father's camel anywhere. Imam Muhammad Bakr looks everywhere. He goes to the grave where they just buried his father, and they see Imam Sajjad's camel lying there on all fours at the head of Imam Sajjad's grave, banging his head against the ground. Nobody up until now has ever seen such a loyal animal. They would ask Imam Muhammad Bakr, why is this camel so loyal to your father? Imam Bakr says that never once did my father whip him or slap him or kick him or lash him. This was a man who would not lash an animal. But every time from the journey from Karbala to Kufa, Kufa to Sham, he wanted to cry for his Baba, he'd be lashed himself. That camel was loyal to Imam Sajjad, just like his Baba Zuljanah was loyal to his Baba. That same Zuljanah, after Asr Ashur, it came back to the Khaymah, and all the women came out, and they began to hug the Zuljanah, and kiss the Zuljanah. And then you see a four-year-old Sakina come running out of the Khaymah, hugging the leg of that Zuljanah, and simply asking the Zuljanah, hey Zuljanah of my Baba, answer me one question. When Shimr ibn Zuljosin separated the head of my father from his body, did they give him a drop of water? Our salams to you tonight, Imam Sajjad. What you saw, nobody saw. What you went through, nobody went through. You went through Ashura, you went through that journey, you went through Sham, and then you went through your own Shahadat. Such that at the very last moment of his life, when Imam Muhammad Bakr realized that his Baba was in pain, our fifth Imam comes close to Imam Sajjad, begins to hug his Baba. Imam Sajjad's head is on Imam Muhammad Bakr's chest. Imam Sajjad's head is on Imam Muhammad Bakr's chest. Imam Sajjad begins to cry, and Imam Muhammad Bakr says, Baba, is there pain anywhere? Is something happening? Can I help you in any way? He says, no, Ya Bunayya, I'm completely okay, but I'm about to leave this world, and my head is on your chest. My Baba Hussein, lest this world with Shimr Jalisu ala Sadr al Hussein. So ya'lamu alladhina zalamu ayya munqalibin yunqalibun inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept this qadil ibadat inshaAllah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that inject us, instill with us, give us that inspiration to build our Islamic courage in this time of fitna and fasad and corruption. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to weaken the hands of the enemies of Islam, inshaAllah. To strengthen the mustaz'afin all over the world, inshaAllah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's so much bloodshed, so much tyranny, so much oppression. We're tired of hearing of our mu'mineen dying every single day. There's one Hussein who's in Ghaybat, who I'm sure is equally in pain every time he hears of one of his Shias dying. We ask you, Allah, to hasten that reappearance and give us the honor, the privilege, and the pride to be his ashab and his ansar when he comes, inshallah. Maqtim al-Hussein.